Accession number 6395, Real 2.
Mr. Spears, Real 2.
At the time of the Italian surrender, Charlie Wilmot had got down to something like 100 weeks in the bag, and I forget the exact number, but so while we were daily expecting to be liberated, he was still going around saying only another 96 more weeks in the bag, and we didn't really know quite what to make of this. But of course we were not in fact liberated. We all ended up in a prison camp in Germany, and he early 1945 he was still saying this, and he was talking, he got down to about 25 or 30 weeks in the bag, and by this time people were beginning to think that he was psychic or something, because he wasn't more than a few weeks out.
Did you know of someone called Stuart Hood in the camp?
I knew him quite well, yes. Stuart Hood, who's in the BBC now, he's an intelligence officer. I had spent a lot of time talking to him. He told me a lot about his activities in the desert, and a lot about the German army, I've got a copy of his book Pebbles in My Skull back at home now.
What role did he play in the camp?
At that stage I lost touch with him. I'm not sure what happened to him after we were taken to Germany, whether he may have escaped at that time, for all I know. But whether he had an intelligence role in the camp, I don't know. But he was a very competent person, and he might well have had that. I don't know. I forget.
But did he act as interpreter for you?
He might have done. I don't. We were not really very much in touch with the Italians. You see, the camp administration, the British officers in charge, did all the dealings that there were to be done about sort of food and discipline and so forth. He may have had some such role. I don't know.
So there was no opportunity to form any kind of personal relationship with any of the Italians?
No.
Did you ever go outside the camp itself?
Once. They negotiated a bathing party on a river. There was a perpetual water shortage, and we were taken out. We gave parole for a space of a few hours in order to be able to have a bathe in the local river, which was rather a curious experience. Hundreds of people bathing in 5 foot of water, surrounded by guards with machine guns. You weren't allowed to put your head under water, of course.
So there was no possibility of forming any contact with Italian civilians?
None at all.
Was there such a thing as batmen for the senior officers in the camp?
There were 200 odd Cypriot other ranks, let's say British Army, who had been allocated on a basis of one per 8 or 10 officers. There was some Geneva Convention protocol on that point. And they lived in a barrack block by themselves and ran the cookhouse.
So they would serve all the officers in the camp, would they?
They didn't actually serve anyone in the sense that a batman normally serves an officer. They merely were the cookhouse staff and did the work associated with that.
So there was no personal service for any officer?
No.
What impression did you get of them, the Cypriots?
One didn't see very much of them. They did cooperate with officers. I know that one tunnel attempt was made from underneath one of the ovens, and a fire was lit over it whenever the camp was searched in order to prevent it from being discovered. So they obviously did cooperate in that sense, but I didn't see very much of them.
Did the Italians ever try to secure collaboration on the part of any POWs?
Not that I'm aware of. There were various attempts, of course, in Germany later, when in the second half of the story, but not so far as I'm aware in Italy.
So the Italians didn't ask any POWs to broadcast for them or anything of that kind?
Not in the camp that I was in.
Did they ever make films of POWs?
No, I think the only incidents that fall into that category were two. The arrival of a cardinal from the Vatican to visit the Catholics amongst the British officers, and he held mass and heard confessions, and dished out small gifts and contributions of one sort or another. We were rather fascinated by the other incident, which occurred a few weeks later, those of us who were not Catholics but Protestants, when a little man wearing a Bersaglieri cap with a great feather in it, in uniform, came into the camp to announce that he was the, I suppose, Archbishop of the Protestant Church of Italy, the Church of Wallachia. And this is a tiny religious group up in the Italian Tyrol, and he was not to be outdone by the Vatican, and had arrived on a tour of the camps, and I think we all felt that had done his best to show sympathy with us.
Can you tell me about any escape attempts that took place at Chieti?
There were a number of attempts, and many attempts considered which never got off the ground. Several tunnels were discovered, and the only successful attempt that I remember was made from a tunnel in which I was involved, distantly involved, at the time of the Italian surrender. We were very close to the Gran Sasso, where Mussolini was held prisoner, and Otto Skorzeny and the German parachute troops who landed on the Gran Sasso to release Mussolini came on and took over the camp. After we had just thought we were about to be released, and the Italian guards were just sort of hanging on, waiting to be taken prisoners themselves, suddenly one morning we found German paratroopers on the guard around the camp, and we were transferred into German control. When we were taken from the camp, as many people as could be got into this one tunnel were put in, and the entrance to it closed down, and they remained in that tunnel until the camp had been evacuated, and then escaped afterwards when the dust had settled. Many of those got through to the Allied lines, of course.
Was there much in the way of making special equipment for escape attempts?
A lot of attempts to concoct types of emergency rations from food that would last, with sort of cocoa, sugar, jam, biscuit, things which would not go bad and could be developed as a sort of pack of food to last for a good length of time. Maps, a good deal of copying of maps. There was a number of people with silk maps of Italy, which had been issued to some people as escape equipment while they were still serving in the army. And these maps were stretched out and copied on tissue paper, a good deal of that. And magnets had been sent concealed in parcels so that compasses could be made. And in fact, I did make a compass myself with them, which consisted of a magnetized sewing needle, and I still have it.
Did you yourself engage in any activity in the way of making radio sets?
At that stage, yes, I did. I was a signal officer, and that was an advantage. Our first attempt was to modify the sound mechanism of an amplifier in a cinematograph projector, to which we had sporadic access, because of course it was locked up and we had to get into the place where it was kept. And we made an attempt there to convert it to a radio, but at that stage we had no success. I built a radio frequency stage to go ahead of the amplifier, but we were still very short of adequate components with which to make a radio work at that point, and in fact we never did succeed in getting one going in Italy.
Did you attempt to secure components by bribing guards?
The bribing of guards, by and large, for that sort of purpose, became centrally controlled at a fairly early stage, a sort of purchasing commission specialization developed fairly early on. And they took charge of that, and in fact achieved remarkable results, especially later on in Germany.
Why not in Italy?
I think we lacked the expertise at that point in how to handle these matters, and we were in a camp in a very poor part of Italy. Comparatively a peasant economy, and the stuff, the equipment was not widely available in that part of Italy. I'm sure that had something to do with it.
But were the Italian guards just as corruptible as the German guards? Or were there differences?
I would have thought so. One comes to this question of second line troops it's only human that in these very boring conditions when guards are undergoing shortages of cigarettes and food themselves, that a certain amount of corruption does develop. And of course we were doing our best to encourage it. But with this wall system around the camp, we know there was not very much contact with guards, and therefore what contact there was had to be exploited to the limit, really. And that is why a specialized organization for doing these things tended to develop.
Was there any case of mental crack-up?
I don't recall anybody in Italy. I can remember a good deal of illness. I can remember shortages of food. You see a great big man, powerful man, reduced to a bag of bones, whereas, oddly enough, metropolitan police inspector who did yogi, I particularly remember, remained physically fit, no matter how little food we appeared to get. I don't remember any cases of mental crack-up, barbed wire-itis, as we used to call it, until we got to Germany.
What were the physical complaints that you referred to?
Usually we had a lot of jaundice, and diarrhea, that kind of thing.
Was there medical treatment?
There was. One of these barrack blocks was designated as a hospital, and there were four or five British doctors who were also prisoners who ran it under the supervision of an Italian medical officer. And some of us trained as masseurs. The British doctors ran a short course in massage to provide themselves with the means of treating wounded officers whose limbs needed physiotherapy after surgery and that type of thing. It was quite a well-run affair.
Were you still at Chieti when the Italian collapse came?
Yes.
Can you describe how the Italian collapse affected you personally?
Yes. We had had in the camp, and one of the great personalities of Chieti was an officer named Lett, who I think had been an intelligence officer, and he made a series of appreciations of what was happening, and this had built up a good deal of excitement in the camp, because it was clear from his interpretations that Mussolini was losing support within the Italian regime, so that in that sense the collapse of the regime came as no great surprise to us in the camp. But when it happened, of course, it was quite interesting. The entire communications between one part of Italy and another broke down. There were limited number of broadcasts, which we, of course, couldn't hear. But since the Italian guards were as much in confusion as we were, they tended to talk to people more. And one learned that the railway driver on a particular train from the direction of Rome had become the source of information about what was happening in Rome and things like that. That gradually the fascists and the anti-fascists sorted themselves out. It polarized. And the Carabinieri, who are a royal institution, tended to come up and take charge, and the fascists disappeared. We, of course, were fascinated then to see the emergence of the Italian newspapers again, printing the BBC news bulletins side by side with the German ones, and all sorts of old pre-fascist journalist writers and editorial writers re-emerged from retirement to take over the press. And for about a week, the press had a field day printing everything without censorship. And when eventually the Bodoglio government sought to reimpose censorship, they went to press with great with the type slashed through in protest against this restriction of freedom. We confidently expected to be released then, and of course were prevailed upon to hang on in the camps until our troops reached us. These were the orders. Many people felt that the opportunity should have been taken to escape while the going was good. But the prevailing instructions, which I believe were authentic, were that we should stay put. And this was how we came to be recaptured effectively by the Skorzeny thing. I think others in other camps, such as Salmona, the entire camp got away and into the mountains, and most of them found their way through the Allied lines and got home at that point. There was a rather splendid story. We were transshipped to Germany via Salmona, and were told there that the Carabinieri guard on the camp of Salmona had actually advised the prisoners to go into the hills before the Germans came, and had remained to delay the German arrival, and had shot it out with the Germans. And when we got to Salmona, the bodies of these Carabinieri were still lying on the hillside outside the camp, where they died, paradoxically, defending the escape of British prisoners. But I think that's about all I could say about the changeover itself. I remember Count Sforza's frantic appeals to the Italian public to stand by the Duce and so forth, but we were not really very interested in the political aspect of it.
So did German troops just come and take over the camp?
They took over the camp, yes.
Can you tell me what happened then?
They remained in charge until we were loaded into cattle trucks and taken to Salmona, where we stayed in the old camp, which had been left by the officers I just mentioned who escaped, until such time as they had organized transport for us to Germany.
Was that a hazardous journey?
To Salmona.
Into Germany?
Yes. One chap was shot trying to escape from the train. Short, Jock Short, his name is. Tried to run for it while we were being loaded into the cattle trucks and was sort of gunned down. And there was a regular fusillade of shots fired along the sides and underneath the cattle trucks at every stop to discourage us from getting out. Quite a number of people did escape. And in fact, a friend of mine, Colonel Sam Derry, who later joined MI9, escaped from one of the trucks which had a wooden floor. It all depended whether you were in a truck with a steel floor or a wooden floor. The wooden floors, people got out. And he escaped before we got to Rome, and went into Rome and formed a POW escape network. He's written a book about it, Rome Escape Line. The rest of us went on by slow stages in the cattle trucks to Germany.
Where were you first taken to in Germany?
To Moosburg, 7A, outside on the main line between Munich and Landshut, Bavaria.
Was that a transit camp?
No, it was a large other ranks camp, multinational, about 30,000 Russians, French, Yugoslavs, and we were 2,000 odd officers, British officers, in one of the many compounds in the camp.
How did conditions there compare with the Italian camps?
Very much dirtier and poorer, much poorer accommodation in wooden huts with separate laboratory facilities which were revolting, and mud, mud and barbed wire. The camp at Chieti had been really buildings of very high quality. With a, they would have been quite suitable as barrack blocks for troops, with the parade ground and so forth. But the German camps were camps, or that one was. Later camps in Germany were, of course, quite different.
Did you have much contact with the POWs of the other nationalities?
Yes, we occasionally saw Russians, and they, of course, were in very poor shape, the Russian prisoners. But we had a lot of French NCOs in an adjoining compound, and it was really through their help that I eventually escaped from the camp. We had quite a lot of contact by bribing the guards on the gate with cigarettes to let us go down and visit them. They had rather more freedom of movement because, being other ranks, they were required to work on the surrounding farms in the, and so they had a greater freedom of movement than we did. But if you could bribe your way out of the gate, you could go down to their part of the camp, and we were, two of us were made welcome down there when we made a number of visits.
Can you give me the details of your escape attempt?
The yes, it was really something which Hugh Butler, a rifle brigade officer, and I decided that we must make an attempt. This was in November 1943. It was winter, but we decided that we were not going to be left in this transit camp, for it was transit as far as we were concerned, that if we didn't attempt to escape at this point, we might find the chance to do so very much smaller at a later stage. So we decided to try, and we went, and we got to know a French sergeant, Jean Mies, who, with various friends of his, when he had decided that we were serious about it, promised to arrange it for us. And this was where it began. We went down, stayed the night in the French compound. The roll calls were fixed by the British Escape Committee in the British compound, and Mies had arranged for us to be put outside the camp. He had also got German money for us, civilian clothes, maps, and he had given us the name of a girlfriend who lived in Lorraine, in Altkirch, and briefed us on how to get to the café where she worked. So that we had most of the ingredients of a successful escape. We had no documentation, but escaping was that sort of thing that a certain number of the requirements came up, and you either took the chance on the rest or you didn't. And it was clear that we had everything except documents, so that we decided to go. And we went with a French working party, up, dressed as French troops, shuffling along in the way that French prisoners did, up to the store where the family parcels from French families were kept for distribution to working parties out, prisoner working parties out on the camps. And we were put in a nearby lavatory to watch what was happening while these parcels were loaded onto a trailer. And at the appropriate point, we were signaled to, and one after the other, we ran down the side of the hut. As we